Okay, so I'd like to first thank the organizers for inviting me to this interesting and very diverse meeting. And it's always nice to spend some time at KITP. So for almost two decades, my research has almost exclusively been focused on trying to understand how the immune system functions and then trying to harness that knowledge towards practical ends. And by way of introduction, let me say that we have an adaptive immune system which is remarkable in that it enables us to mount pathogen-specific responses against a diverse and evolving world of microbes, including ones that may not have evolved when you were born. To roughly see how this works, consider infection with a virus. A virus hijacks the transcriptional machinery of the host cell, enabling the synthesis of viral proteins and the assembly of new virus particles that can go on to infect other cells. Now, B cells are important players in adaptive immunity. Most B cells have a receptor on their surface that is distinct from the receptor on the surface of another B cell. If the receptor on this particular B cell can bind sufficiently strongly to the proteins that make up the spikes of this virus, then biochemical reactions cause it to get activated, it starts to proliferate, and a Darwinian evolutionary process occurs in a very short time, which I shall describe soon, that ultimately leads to the secretion of soluble and even more higher affinity forms of this receptor, and that is what is called an antibody. These antibodies can then bind specifically and strongly to the spikes on the surface of this particular virus and dispose of it in a number of different ways, which I shall not describe. But antibodies principally do battle with virus particles that are free in your blood or extracellular spaces. Now, some of these viral proteins are chopped up into short peptides, about 10 amino acids long, and are displayed on the surface of infected cells in complex with human proteins called MHC proteins. We each have 6 to 12 types of MHC proteins, but there are thousands of variants of the MHC protein in the human population, and different MHCs tend to bind different types of peptides. T cells are also important players in adaptive immunity. Again, most T cells have a receptor on their surface that's distinct from that on another. And if the receptor on this particular T cell can bind strongly to this particular viral peptide, biochemical reactions activate it, it starts to proliferate, and it can coordinate an immune response in a number of different ways. For instance, one type of T cell called a CTL is such that if an activated CTL sees another cell displaying the same peptide that originally activated it, it can secrete products that will kill this infected cell and the virus particles they harbor. Now, after you have cleared an infection, most of the B cells and T cells that proliferated in response to this particular infection will die. But a few remain as so-called memory cells that can mount robust and rapid responses upon reinfection with the same pathogen. This pathogen-specific immunological memory is the basis for vaccination. With a vaccine, you try to induce memory B cells, T cells, and antibodies that are specific for the bug against which you wish to protect the host. Now, vaccination has saved more lives than any other medical procedure. There's no debate about this except in certain parts of California. But today, some pathogens have evolved that defy successful vaccination using the empirical paradigms that were pioneered by Pasteur and Jenner over two centuries ago. HIV is a prominent example. What is required in order to eliminate such scourges from the planet is rational rather than empirical design of vaccines based on understanding of the mechanistic principles for the pertinent immunology and virology. Now, a major barrier to the quest for a vaccine against HIV is the high mutability of the virus. In these phylogenetic trees, the number of N's corresponds to the diversity of circulating strains. And you can see this diagram, which is to scale, that the diversity of the flu virus in the entire world in a particular year is comparable to the diversity of HIV strains in a single infected individual, and completely dwarfed by the diversity of strains in just one region of Africa. So this high mute presents a major challenge for vaccination because HIV can mutate in order to evade vaccine-induced T cells and antibodies that lie ready and waiting for certain strains. Now we work on both the T cell and antibody arms of this challenge, and our work on the T cell arm is very mature and focused a lot on getting the fitness landscape of the virus. We have inference driven by data, simulation, theory, extensive tests with in vitro and clinical data, and our vaccine concept for a T cell arm of this vaccine is going to be tested soon in monkeys, which is a very scary thing, maybe from statistical physics to monkeys. But our work on the antibody arm is far less mature. But not being a rational person, I'm going to spend most of my time telling you about our antibody work, because my hope is that you will be able to provide some input that will help us make further progress. And if time permits in the end, I will take a few minutes to tell you one aspect of the work on T cells that makes an interesting connection between our fitness landscape of HIV and Hopfield models of associative networks. So I'll begin the story on antibodies by telling you about some work that we published a little while ago that was led by Shenzhen Wang, who was a postdoc then, but is now in the physics faculty at UCLA. And I think many of you know this gentleman, who is my colleague at MIT and collaborates with me on many questions. And it also involves collaboration with immunologists and bioengineers in ways that you will see. I will then tell you about some work that was published more recently, which was led by Scott Schaefer in my group, and also involved Mehran and immunologist Penny Moore. And then I will tell you about some unpublished work that involves postdoc Kayla Sprenger, John, who was a postdoc till very recently, but is now on the faculty, physics faculty at UC, and Joy LeVue, who's a student. So, upon natural infection or vaccination, antibodies are produced by a Darwinian evolutionary process called affinity maturation, which occurs in a very short time. So as I told you, when a B cell's receptor can bind sufficiently strongly to the spike on the surface of this particular virus, it gets activated, starts to proliferate, and can seed structures inside your lymph nodes called germinal centers. So here, a gene called AID gets turned on, which starts introducing mutations into the antigen binding region of their receptors of the B cells at a very high rate, a process called somatic hypermutation. These B cells with mutated receptors now interact with the antigen that originally activated them that is displayed on the surface of cells called FDCs. If the receptor on this particular B cell can bind sufficiently strongly to this antigen, it will eat it up. And then it will chop it inside into short peptides, bind it to MHC that it has, and display it on its surface. And then these different B cells that successfully ate antigen compete with each other to interact with limiting numbers of another kind of T cell called T helper cell. And if the receptor on this T helper cell can bind productively with this peptide MHC, peptide derived from the antigen, then a survival signal is given. Otherwise, the B cell dies. So you can see that B cells with receptors that bind more strongly to the antigen is more likely to eat antigen, more likely, therefore, to display more peptides on their surface, and therefore more likely to be able to win this competition. But all of these are stochastic points, of course. Now, a small fraction of the positively selected B cells are let out as memory cells and so-called plasma cells, which secrete soluble forms of the receptor, and that's an antibody. But the vast majority of these positively selected cells are recycled for further rounds of mutation and selection. So you can see that as time ensues, the affinity of the antibody for the antigen is going to grow. So ever since my late MIT colleague Herman Eisen described this process for the first time in 1964, it has been the subject of a lot of experimental studies, and new discoveries continue to be made. And it is also the problem in immunology that had been studied the most via computation. My own interest in this problem was piqued by the following. This is a schematic depiction of the viral spike of HIV. It contains some conserved residues, such as those shown in yellow here, relatively conserved, because they have to bind to human receptors in order to propagate infection. But they are surrounded by highly variable residues shown here in red and protected by sterically by these blue sugar-like molecules. Now, recently, immunologists like Dennis Burton and Michelle Nussensweig have been able to isolate antibodies from infected patients, from some infected patients, which are such that, at least in vitro, they are able to neutralize diverse strains of HIV. These so-called broadly neutralizing antibodies, or bNAbs, bind to regions of the viral spike, also called the epitope, that contain these conserved residues. The trouble is that in these infected people, these bNAbs usually emerge several years after infection and very low numbers, so they're not helpful for this person. Nonetheless, they provide proof of concept that the human immune system can evolve such broadly neutralizing antibodies and raise the tantalizing possibility that properly designed vaccination protocols might be able to induce such antibodies in a diverse group of people efficiently. So I think you can see right away that the induction of broadly neutralizing antibodies will require vaccination with more than one strain of HIV or some mimic of it. Because if you immunize with one strain, this Darwinian evolutionary process will produce a very nice strain-specific antibody. So you have to immunize with multiple variant strains which share some conserved residues, but have mutations that are different from each other in the variable parts. So once you realize that, you recognize that you have many questions to answer. What should be these variant antigens? What is the temporal pattern in which you give them, as a cocktail, sequentially, or various permutations that you can imagine? What concentrations? How many? What should be the mutational distances that separate the variable regions of these variant antigens? So the answers to these questions are drawn from a large space of possibilities, and it may be difficult to find the golden nuggets that you seek by randomly sampling the space with experiments using monkeys, which are the only animal model we have for HIV today. Yes, sir?
Can't you just inject the conserved part?
So if you do that, then what will happen is that the antibodies will not learn how to avoid the variable parts. Because in the real bug, they will have this variable part surrounding it, as well as all the steric barriers and so on and so on. But you should start with that, so that you get the memory B cells generated that target that, and then put in the complexity of it. And the second step is what we'll consider. But you see why just giving that will not work. Okay, so mechanistic understanding of affinity maturation, which has been studied for essentially as long as I've been alive, should provide guidelines to choose the answers to these questions. The trouble is that until 3 years ago, affinity maturation had only been studied in the context of single model antigens. So what happens when you have these multiple variant antigens was not understood, still not understood. So this is why, in order to build some intuition, we started to construct computational models of affinity maturation in this setting, with two goals. One, perhaps a very practical one, to focus immunization strategy in some more plausible directions. But the other is to get intuition that can guide building of a much more mechanistic and detailed fundamental understanding of this basic problem in immunology was not studied because we were not dealing with this practical question. Yes?
No, so in terms of, you're now talking about the HIV antigen variant, but in general,
so, the difference is that immune system deals with TB and say influenza, they are so different that different kinds of B cells attack them. The first B cell that goes after them is different. Here you have to have this B cell target that conserved residue which is surrounded by variable parts, and these variable parts are just somewhat different from one bug to the other. So that's, they're variant antigens rather than very different antigens. And that's the key to it. And frankly, we have not dealt with chronic infections that are highly mutable. It's one of the many reasons why HIV is the only example of a bug against which we are trying to make a vaccine where there is no single example of a human who had naturally cleared the infection. All other things for which we have vaccines, and most that we don't have vaccines for, there are proofs of concept of naturally clearing the infection. I gave you more long answer than. Okay, so what is this computational model that we started to build? We can give them fancy names like agent-based stochastic model. We know what that means. It simply means that the computer is given a set of rules which are derived from knowledge of what happens in affinity maturation in mice and humans when they are given single antigens, and then the computer executes this rule, but now in the setting where there's multiple variant antigens and complexity that you may have difficulty in intuiting can emerge because of the coupling of the rules, as you will see. So, this is what it does. A few B cells that bind to the antigen with affinity exceeding the threshold can see the germinal center. Mutations turn on at the experimentally known rate. We know from experiment that functionally silent mutations are about half of them. Lethal mutations are about 0.3, lethal because the receptor doesn't fold at all. And then the rest are affinity-affecting mutations. And for the affinity-affecting mutations, we change the interaction free energy of the B cell I with antigen variant J. Again, following experiment on protein-protein interfaces, we know that mutations are more likely to be deleterious than helpful, and that is taken from fitting experiment in protein-protein interfaces, which is a log normal distribution. Then selection occurs in two steps, as I've already told you. There is a probability with which a B cell receptor can internalize antigen, and we use a simple Langmuir form. So, you know, the probability goes up as the affinity of the receptor is higher. And there's a similar stochastic term for competition for T cell hub. Now, when you have multiple antigens, some things we just don't know from experiment. For example, on these cells on which the antigen is displayed, are the variant antigens displayed so homogeneously that every time a B cell interacts in this interface, it sees all types of antigens? Or is it distributed sufficiently heterogeneously so that at any one interaction it sees one type of antigen? Not one antigen, one type of antigen. So this nothing is known about this. So we've done calculations in two asymptotic level limits. And I'll show you, the outcome is very dependent on which of these scenarios is true, suggesting more experimental interrogation of this question. Okay. For most of what I show you, but not until the end, we will have a very coarse-grained representation of the free energy of interaction between the antigen and the B cell receptor. So this is the antigen to which the B cell receptor binds, and I told you that's called the epitope. It has conserved residues and variable residues. The conserved residues are represented by spin variables plus one, and the variable residues will take on spin variables plus one and minus one. And the B cell receptor residues that interact with them are described by fields H, which couple to these spin variables. So the free energy of interaction is given like this for interactions with the variable residues, where these spin variables can be plus or minus one. And for the conserved part, it's this because the spin variables are one. Now, this neglects the three-dimensional part of this interaction. So informed by crystal structures, we further add some salad dressing to this, which is not totally unimportant. And that is this, that we know that when there are mutations in these variable residues, they insert a whole loop, which can become a steric barrier to the B cell receptor accessing that yellow conserved regions I showed you. So therefore, in the models, I forgot to say that these H fields evolve during the mutation process. That's what's evolving as the B cell receptor is evolving. So if during by mutation, the H field for interaction with one of the variable residues that is mutated goes down, then a randomly chosen residue of the B cell receptor that interacts with the conserved residue, its affinity is increased because that is to represent that you have better steric access to that region. And the inverse is also true. So now the computation goes very simply. There's activation, followed by this replication and mutation, selection, and as I told you, a small fraction go out, and the rest go back through many cycles. When do you end the calculation? Again, informed by experiment. One way you end the calculation is when all the B cells die. It's an evolutionary process. Extinction is perfectly possible. Another way you end it is when the number of B cells in this germinal center exceed a threshold amount. That is a proxy for saying that the B cells have been growing, and so they've eaten up all the antigen now, and so there's nothing they have to drive the selection process. And finally, when a maximum time is exceeded, and that's because there's an antigen decay time that is finite, and therefore, again, this is a proxy for the fact that the antigen is gone. Yes?
Just to keep us on track, you're describing this effect is after you get immunized.
Yes, or naturally infected. We are going to study only immunization.
Pardon?
We are going to study only immunization.
So when the antigen is gone, you're not worried about the antigen multiplying itself?
Because of vaccine. Yeah, because it's a vaccine. Absolutely. If you had a replicating virus, then that's not the issue.
So in a follicular dendritic cell you were showing, does a given dendritic cell just have one antigen, one epitope, or does it display a whole bunch of different?
No, it potentially displays a whole bunch of different ones. What we don't know is whether they are so homogeneously that in the scale of the interface between a single B cell, it sees many or one.
I see, okay.
But it certainly has many.
And then you said about the variants on the antigen, you can't just have an epitope that just has a conserved part. You're saying the epitope would also include some variants.
If you don't, then you will train the system beautifully to deal with just the conserved residue. But the actual virus will not come with just the conserved residue. It will come with all these variable parts around it, which interfere with the binding, as well as all the steric barriers. You have not taught it how to avoid them.
Okay,
so after we do this calculation, antibodies come out, and then we use a similar model to check the affinity of the antibody for a large panel of strains, which are actually motivated by a strain panel that is used to actually assay for the breadth of these antibodies in reality when they come out. And then we check this affinity for all these strains, and the breadth of coverage of that antibody is defined as the fraction of strains that bind with affinity above some threshold. And because evolution is a stochastic process, for exactly the same conditions, we run the calculation many times, collect statistics, and we'll present our results as histograms that will define, or we think will define, the probability that a typical vaccinated person will make antibodies of a certain breadth. Yes?
So it seems to me that, sorry, this is about the last question, that you have the thing where you say, well, there's the non-conserved things, and if they bind better, then the conserved part will bind worse, and vice versa. But it's like steric, and so is there evidence that that's true?
Absolutely. From this crystal structure, that's true. And perhaps at the end, because the slide is quite late, we also see that the conserved residues are much smaller than the footprint of the B cell receptor.
Uh-huh.
So the thing is that as soon as you have these variable residues, the typical thing we would like to do is just put a huge footprint that includes these guys. But that would be okay because the variable residue will change. So it's got to educate itself through this Darwinian evolutionary process to focus down on those conserved residues.
Okay. Is epitope usually very short? In
T cell receptors.
Oh, it's bigger for.
Yeah, T cell receptors are just 9 to 10 mers on MHC, which we think a lot about. But here, the epitope is about 12 angstroms to 15 angstroms in diameter, the footprint of the antibody. Yeah.
I don't know if this is a well-defined question, but in terms of the sort of the sequence distance between the variants that you're trying to program the B cells for versus the different strains, what sort of a kind of numbers that
Let me show you what we've done. We've done this across a range of these things, and it's a very important variable, as you will see. So if you wait a little bit, you'll get a better sense of it. Okay, so first, actually right away. So the results I'm going to show you are where we had three variant antigens which contained some shared conserved residues, but their variable parts were separated by relatively large mutational distance of 11 non-overlapping mutations, and the numbers being present there being 28. variable residues, okay? And what we'll look at is the results we got by just putting a bunch of all three of them simultaneously in this in on the FDCs. So this is the probability of getting antigens antibodies of different breadth, with one being perfect coverage of this panel. So you can see that in this case, there's very low probability of getting these cross-reactive antibodies. We also find that very few antibodies are made, that in most germinal centers just die, extinguish. What is the reason for this? Can be seen quite vividly by first considering the situation where when a B cell comes and interacts with this FDC, it sees only one type of variant antigen at a time. I'll tell you what happens if that is not the case. So in this cartoon, these are three variant antigens that share these red conserved residues, and the different colors here represent that they have different mutations in the variable residues. So imagine a B cell during rounds of mutation and selection that interacts only with this guy in one cycle and is positively selected. Now it mutates, and it goes, and this time, let's say it interacts with a different one. In the early stages of affinity maturation, the affinity of the receptor for the antigen is not very high, so it is unlikely that strong interactions have been built with the conserved residues yet. And therefore, it is unlikely that we'll bind strongly to this second type of variant antigen, and so the likely outcome is going to be death. The point I'm trying to make is that these variant antigens are conflicting selection forces that can frustrate this Darwinian evolutionary process. And I mean frustration in somewhat slightly technical way, if you like. If you think about it, for this B cell I to keep surviving in successive rounds of mutation and selection, its interaction-free energy with each of these antigens must exceed a certain threshold. Because the S variables are different for these antigens, until you build up this part, which is the conserved residue, to be sufficiently strong, this is very difficult to simultaneously satisfy. Now, in many systems that we are all familiar with, when you have this sort of frustration where local stability is not compatible with global stability, you get very interesting behavior. In these non-equilibrium systems in biology, what you have is extinction, because you can die. So that's the outcome that happens here when you have frustration. Sorry, you had questions.
So how is this different from getting three different flu viruses at the same time?
Yeah, it's first of all, this is rare in the same person simultaneously, because flu is an acute infection, but it can happen. But when it happens, the antigen variation is sufficient that a different B cell receptor will go and target a different region of that epitope. So, if you,
there are different B cell receptors that have evolved from the same original one.
No, amongst the B cells that we have, a naive one will start before it. And if it's very close in the sequence space, you will either get a very good response, or if it's slightly further back, you will get a worse response than if you didn't have the first one. And in fact, as I'll point out in a few minutes, I didn't plan to do that, but I will tell you what happens in flu for something that works here that is also happening. These problems with some variation are also relevant for flu. Okay. Now, of course, if you start to see all types of variant antigens every time in this interaction, this frustration that I described is gone, because now you can keep seeing the same guy again and again and again and keep evolving to that. But then there is no selection force that's driving cross-reactivity. So you'll get a bunch of strain-specific antibodies, and strain-specific to the small number that you are putting. Okay? And that's what we predict. I'm going to show you that. Now, with the same antigens, if we deliver them sequentially, you give one, do affinity maturation, then you have memory cells that are produced, you take a small fraction of them and see the GC with the second one, and so on. If you do that, then you see that we predict that there's a higher probability of getting these cross-reactive antibodies, and you also get more of them. Again, in terms of a cartoon, the basic reason why that is the case. Please focus on this part of the cartoon, which shows the footprint of the B cell receptor or antibody on this antigen. So when you give the first one, you get a broad footprint that covers both the conserved region and the variable region. Well, there's no variable region, it's one guy. Okay? So then you do the second one, and we see that, roughly speaking, two types of lineages evolve. One type of lineage just solves the problem of having these mutations by strengthening interactions with the conserved residues. Another one strengthens interactions with the variable residues that are shared between these two. But now when you come with a third one that has non-overlapping mutations between these two, this type of lineage gets in trouble because it has to undo these and make new ones, whereas this guy has a path to keep going forward and building strong interactions with conserved residues and then also becomes cross-reactive. Now this basic prediction that a cocktail of variant antigens separated by large mutational distances will do worse upon vaccination to get breadth compared to sequential with the same ones has been experimentally tested in model experiments in mice by our collaborators whose pictures I showed you earlier. So here they made four variant antigens. GP120 is one of the proteins that makes up the spike. It contains conserved residue, and then they put variations around in the variable regions, and then they vaccinated mice with a cocktail of these things. And the data shown here is the binding affinity of the antibodies that are produced just for these antigens, not even the whole panel. Okay, and you can see that for the cocktail, you have a wide distribution of binding affinities. They're not cross-reactive. And for the sequential, you have a narrower distribution that is cross-reactive. And they also did many assays, which in the interest of time, I think I'll skip, showing that for sequential immunization, they did focus down on the conserved residues, whereas in the cocktail, they did not. Since then, there have also been other studies with more elaborate mouse experiments with something called humanized mice, which we can discuss later, not right now. By Michelle Nussenzweig and Bill Schief, that again emphasize this sequential immunization. For flu, what people see is that when you do sequential immunization, again mouse models, but also humans who have been infected once by H1 and another time by H2, what you find is that because the antigenic region of this is much bigger, so you can introduce a mutation here and here, they don't try to find any conserved residues here, but there's a conserved residue in the stock of the spike. And you see that you get antibody responses to the stock part, which has conserved residues.
So why the flu shots simultaneously try to immunize you?
Because the stock is hidden very beautifully by flu. And that's the reason why we know naturally that's not the dominant response. The dominant response comes against the head of the spike, which is highly variable. The stalk is hidden because flu has a very high density of spikes on its surface. So the stalk, which is here, as you can see, it's harder for B cells to access that. And one way we can think about HIV, on the other hand, but we will not discuss this today, but HIV, on the other hand, has the lowest spike density, two orders of magnitude lower than flu, for example. So that's the reason why they don't develop. But that is a goal. Peter Pulesi and Frank Crummell in the flu arena are trying to figure out how to immunize sequentially to get stock-specific antibodies to develop such that you would have then a universal vaccine. You wouldn't need that. Need to do this again and again. Yes, sir.
In terms of the sequencing, if I think of each, learning to recognize each type as some kind of a pattern recognition problem, then it looks like
it's statistical mechanics of learning.
Right. So it shouldn't make a difference whether I present it sequentially or not, but I guess that the critical difference is that there is sort of this degradation.
Exactly. The equilibrium behavior of the system, and I think that's what you're going. The equilibrium behavior of the system, if you write down equilibrium model, whether it's cocktail or sequential, they're completely irrelevant, okay? But the dynamics is, and the dynamics in these systems has an interesting absorbing boundary condition called death. And that's why it's all these problems. You have to, as I'll describe more, this frustrate, well, let me come to this, okay?
That's for T cell receptors.
But they don't get
get chopped up on for the dendritic
cells? No, this is the difference between B cells and T cells. The two parts evolved. The B cell is older, evolutionarily, I mean. It evolved by just binding to things on the surface of the virus, okay, or the bacterium. And then we realized, well, evolution realized, that what do we do with all these internal proteins? They're bigger targets. And then the T cell evolved.
Okay, because I thought you showed it looking, the B cell was looking at the dendritic cell, the MHCs on the dendritic cell.
No, the opposite. The B cell, after it eats antigen, it cuts it up into peptides and displays it for T helper cells, which provide the final survival signal.
Okay.
But what the B cell saw was an intact antigen and only the spike. We can also discuss why T cells don't carry out this affinity maturation process. They do not evolve in real time, and we can discuss why they do that. It would cause you tremendous trouble if they did that. Okay, so then our immunologist friends, some of them told us, you know, okay, the cocktail you looked at was three variant antigens with large mutational distance. What if you did a cocktail, but you changed the number of antigens, and you also changed the mutational distances between them? What would happen then? Maybe you won't get so much depth. So we did this calculation. So let me show you this axis. The number of antigens is increasing in this direction. But as we increase the number of antigens, we also decrease the mutational distance separating the antigens. So what you have on this axis in this region is a few antigens separated by large mutational distances, and you here you have a large number of antigens separated by tiny mutational distances. And this is our prediction of the average breadth, and you can see that there appears to be an optimal number of antigens separated by an optimal mutational distance that gives you the highest breadth. Now, a metric of frustration is how many of the germinal centers you simulated died under that condition. The more died, the more the frustrated the system is. Okay, so this is that, same axis here. This is the fraction of germinal centers that died. And you can see here, just as we saw before with the cocktail, it's high frustration, a lot of these things are just dying. Here, of course, almost nothing is dying because these are almost the same antigen. They're separated by one mutational distance. So it appears that the intermediate level of frustration promotes the evolution of these cross-reactive antibodies. The essence of this is very easy to understand in hindsight. Look at what happens to each B cell in every round of mutation and selection. It can either not mutate and survive, it can mutate and survive, or it can die. There's no other outcome that can happen to this. So let's say the probability of survival of a B cell is PS. It depends on the receptor, of course. But it also depends on all these things we've been studying, the mutational distance, the number of antigens, the concentration, so on and so on. And mu is the mutation probability. So what's the probability that you will populate this path? Well, it did not mutate, and it survived. This one is PS times mu, mutated and survived, and this is 1 minus PS. Now, when you make the conditions very frustrating, PS is very low, survival probability, and so you populate this path. You get that. Now, what if you make the survival probability very high, non-frustrated situation? Many antigens are almost the same. Well, PS is very high and mu is less than 1. So you will quickly populate this every round of replication, as opposed to this. So you'll fill up the B cell and eat up all the antigen before you have acquired all the mutations that are required to get know these conserved residues and avoid the variable residues. That's why you need this Goldilocks-like situation where PS is intermediate, so you can keep populating this path and collecting these mutations that you need in order to achieve this. Now, this principle of optimal frustration, as we are calling it, awaits experimental test. But if you think about it, if it holds up, which I have a hunch that it will be true, then the essence of the challenge is the following. Affinity maturation is a non-equilibrium dynamic process which has two strong attractors. One is the value of death, when your frustration becomes too high. The other is strain-specific antibodies when frustration is too low. And it seems in many cases we are studying and what have been studied naturally, there's a narrow ridge line that takes you to this weaker attractor that you seek. And what you want to do is manipulate these frustrating conditions in such a way that this narrow ridge line becomes this broad stairway to heaven, if you like. And the trouble we are having is, in spite of all this stuff I've shown you, we don't know how the frustration depends on these various variables and how they couple and so on, so how do we manipulate in an intelligent fashion? So one of the things we've been doing is doing lots of calculations just to get intuition, doing many, many, many different cases. I'm not going to take you through all the stuff that we have done, because they are meant mainly to build intuition. But there seems to be some consensus in these studies that there is an optimal temporal trajectory of frustration that does the very best in getting you these cross-reactions, not just setting it one time and waiting. Let me show you two examples that have led to this, and I'll be just flash these results, because then I can go a little bit to the other part of the problem. So this is a case where we consider three antigens in a cocktail and two antigens that will sequentially be given after that. This axis is the sum of the mutational distances between pairs of these five antigens. So as I'm changing this way, I'm changing what are the identities of these antigens, but they are the same, otherwise, three antigens and two antigens. So here's what you see. This is the mean breadth. You can see that the diagrams are not of good quality yet, but this is what happens. You give the cocktail first and then sequential. Same antigens. Give the sequence first and then cocktails. You see the temporal pattern matters. These various dots are various concentrations. We've done many, many such cases, and a diagram that I was not bold enough to put up, but I showed Remy yesterday because he's working on some analytical things on this. You can, with certain scaling, you can take all the stuff we have and collapse it onto one master curve. We don't understand this scaling, but it has information. And the information has what we do understand is that it says the frustration should be low in the beginning and higher as time progresses. We also see this in another context. And now I'll start putting a bit more detail into the structure of these antibodies and so on in the next two slides. So this is a schematic representation of the antibody or the B cell receptor. This is the antigen binding region that we've been talking about. But there's also this region right adjacent to it, which is called the framework region and designated with FWL. Mutations are much rarer in framework mutations. Its purpose is more largely to keep some structural integrity to this whole thing. And the common paradigm, learned from studying affinity maturation with single antigens, is that these rare framework mutations, as they happen during affinity maturation, the B cell receptor starts out in the early stages being somewhat flexible, so that it, you know, it can bind to this antigen or that antigen, depending on what you got infected by. But as time progresses, these framework mutations make the structure more rigid, therefore you don't lose this entropic freedom when you bind, and so it becomes more specific for this particular guy, and also the free energy goes up. That's the paradigm. Framework mutations that evolve make the antibody more stiff. So we have looked at the role of framework mutations on evolution of bNAbs. I learned that our paper is accepted during the previous talk, so I changed the thing, not the piece on the previous session, so it's just been accepted. So the framework mutations are much more common in these cross-reactive antibodies. They're much more. So I'm going to tell you everything we did, but in order to address this question and many other questions we are doing now, we have added more structural and realism to the interaction free energies. We don't know how to do that, so we have collaborated with Martin Karpis's lab, who knows how to do these atomistically detailed MD-Kim calculations, and then we have coupled that to our evolutionary dynamics that remain coarse-grained, but the free energy contribution comes from there. But as a first step, we studied three lineages of cross-reactive antibodies that evolved naturally in some humans. So they evolved with many different antigens present, because I showed you how much diversity there is in a single person. And they had structures on the germline B cell, which means the starting point, the ancestor that started the process, an intermediate and the mature antibody. And based on these studies, here's what we have found. If the germline B cell already binds sufficiently strongly to the conserved residues, then the traditional paradigm happens. framework mutations make it more stiff so that it can focus down only on those parts. It doesn't worry about the rest. But in the more likely situation, where the germline B cell receptor is not binding strongly to the conserved residues already, we find that in this frustrating antigen diversity situation, the B cells framework mutations that survive are the ones that make the antibody actually more flexible, because now it can bind modestly to these various things and survive this, and then it starts to acquire mutations that build strongly, that build into the antigen binding region, that make it stronger, and then once that is acquired, then it rigidifies again. So it goes through again, this time the B cell receptor is making frustration low in the beginning to keep going, and then making it harder as time goes on.
So I was about to ask you, the flexibility that these have to have, how much of it is flexible, structural, and is there any sort of lessons to take from IDPs and how they're designed?
So they're not as flexible as IDRs and IDPs, if that's what you mean. But there are estimates. I can't remember them because for one of these lineages, they did these thermal stability. So there is some estimate. But they are folded proteins. I mean, they are very structurally still intact. Yeah. Okay, so I don't know. I mean, I could tell you now about this analogy with the Hopfield model. It will take about 7 or 8 minutes. Should I do that or not do that?
Started you early.
Yeah, so I should finish, I think. Yeah. So I'll stop there and skip. Should I do that? Okay. I'll take only 6 or 7 minutes. I'll skip it quickly. Okay. So very quickly, so this goes back to the T cell side of the story. Because of the high mutability of the virus, and now all these peptide story that you're telling, all the internal proteins is now true. Right, because we're not going to talk about T cells. So because of the high mutability of the virus, there has been interest in focusing a T cell response to peptides that contain single residues that appear relatively conserved when you look at the sequence of the same HIV protein derived from various virus samples from diverse patients. The idea is that if a T cell hits such a residue, HIV will have to evolve a mutation there to avoid the T-cell pressure, but that should likely make the virus unfit. Otherwise, why do you see it relatively conserved? But this strategy is blunted because HIV can evolve other mutations, so-called compensatory mutations, that can partially restore the fitness cost incurred by making the first one. These compensatory mutations could be rare, but because HIV replicates and mutates so quickly, it can access it in a chronic infection. So, what we need in order to define the mutational vulnerabilities of the virus is to account for these collective compensatory pathways that the virus uses to evade human immunity so as to not target them with a vaccine-induced immune response, and also identify, you know, the combinations of mutations the virus cannot make and remain viable in order to simultaneously target them with an induced response. Or, to this audience, I don't need to say what I mean, you need the fitness landscape of HIV. Once you have the fitness landscape, you can design vaccines more rationally and so on and so on. So let me, in the interest of time, not tell you how you would design a vaccine if you had such a fitness landscape, but rather simply remark that over a number of years, we've tried to extract this fitness landscape of HIV. A number of people played a role in this. All of these people are independent faculty members now, and some of these people, well, from their pictures, you can see they're also independent faculty members now, but and so on. But here's what we do, and I won't spend much time on the first part. We use inference using computation to extract the fitness landscape from the sequence data, because we have thousands and thousands of sequences of HIV that are available now. We start out by seeking the prevalence landscape. What is the probability of observing a certain sequence indicated by vector Z circulating in the population? And the way we extract it is, many people have tried such things. We ask, what is the least biased or maximum entropy model for this probability distribution that by construction fits these mutational probability correlations? As you know, if you do that, then the probability distribution you will get looks like that, where the fields HI and the couplings GIJ are extracted by fitting the 1 and 2 point mutation probabilities. But this is still a prevalence landscape. You could argue that the prevalence, more prevalent strains are also more fit, but But this could be highly complicated because these strains of virus were extracted from humans in whom there was a battle between the immune response and the virus, and individual humans could have forced the virus to mutate in certain ways that made it intrinsically less fit, but was the fittest virus in this guy. So we did a lot of work, which I shall not talk about. In theory, computation, and now it's been tested extensively against in vitro and clinical data, which shows that for HIV and not flu, Boris couldn't come today, but he's done a lot of work on the flu and extracting its fitness landscape. And only for HIV, for many reasons associated with its pathogenesis and its biology, the prevalence landscape and fitness landscape are very simply related. For flu, it is not. Roughly speaking, the flu population is strongly driven out of equilibrium. The HIV population over some range of sequence distance is more or less at steady state. And therefore, it is a big part of the reason, as well as the fact that it's a chronic infection, and so a huge diversity of T cell responses are targeted. So it's pushed around in all these places, but no effective response. It comes back again, and so on and so on. Exactly. It's not been driven by effective immune responses. There's no memory kernel in the Fokker-Planck-like description, if you like. Okay, but the point I want to tell you now is this. And it'll take me only about 2-3 minutes. So these JIJs, they have both positive and negative signs. The positive sign means that two mutations are compensatory. Negative sign means that two together are worse than if they were happen one at a time. That means that they are is very similar to Hopfield models of associative networks, associative memories. So does that happen? Okay, so we have a fitness landscape. You can take every sequence that is known, take our fitness landscape, and just do a steepest descent and see if they go to particular hills, or in Hopfield language, particular valleys or basins. Well, that happens. And from now on, I'll call them basins. So they partition into a few basins. Just like Hopfield networks, if you characterize each basin by the sequence corresponding to its bottom tip, you will find that the majority of mutations in this basin sequence are shared by all the ones that fell into it. So it's like that you see a fuzzy thing that's partly okay, you go down to that particular thing. You also find, so you can also characterize the basins by the number of sequences that fell into a basin. And then you can rank order these basins with the most populous basin being ranked 1. So this is what you get for GAG. These are classic ZIF plots. Power law. Here's another HIV protein, NEF. Power law. Which means that there's no typical size of these basins. Okay? Another HIV protein. Not a power law. Decidedly not. Only a couple of basins have all the sequences. Integrate another HIV protein, same thing. What we find is that the ones that have a power law are highly immunogenic, which means that humans tend to target these proteins a lot. The ones that are not power law are ones that the humans don't target very much. So this is my last slide. Why is this happening? And why is it so similar to Hopfield's associative memories? So look at the immunogenic proteins first. There's no question that immune responses, ineffective as they may be, they force the virus to sample sequence space. We see this because if you go look at the basin sequence, the one at the tip, you'll see that the mutations are at sites that are often targeted by humans. And they cause fitness for the virus. So we also see that the other mutations in the basin sequence are enormously enriched in ones that are positively coupled with the human mutant that was forced, because those positive couplings restore the fitness. And it's these collective effects that define a basin. Now, just like in Hopfield, these are memories. These are memories stored in the HIV population of how it won battles against the human immune response. And that is what you're seeing. Okay? Why is it power law? There's a huge diversity of human immune responses. It also is actually power law distributed. So there's no typical immune response. So there's no typical immune response to evade. There's no typical compensatory pathway mutations to make. The whole distribution of compensatory mutations, different compensatory mutations represent different levels of constraint. different numbers of sequences are compatible with different levels of constraint. Non-immunogenic proteins, none of this happens. So I've kept you long enough. I'm very sorry. I will stop right there. And thank you for your attention.
All right. Thanks a lot. Still lots of time for questions. If you let me just start at the back. And
okay, so I have a question. If you take one patient which is infected by HIV throughout its, his or her entire life, you can have an idea of the effective number of strains and the diversity, okay, of sequences it is, confronted to. So, and then you said it takes maybe a few years to get these BNABs, okay? So my question is whether these models, your model can actually reproduce this very small probability of getting BNABs in these particular conditions.
So first of all, I should tell you that we have not done simulations or theory looking at coevolution of the virus and the antibodies, because we were looking at vaccination scenario. But we have done something that may be a mimic. The experimental data on humans, by that I mean just following clinical blood samples, shows that these people mostly tend to make these broadly neutralizing antibodies shortly after there's some huge diversification of the viral swarm. Okay? So the calculation we did was we first gave one antigen, got memory cells from there, seeded another germinal center, but now with the distribution of antigens. And there we see that there is a low probability that histogram develops a low probability on this side. And that is because during that first phase, some few antibodies developed with strong interactions with the conserved residues, which could with low probability survive in this antigenic thing. That's the only thing we have done. But it's others have, I think we should try to do this coevolution also to understand what's going on.
How long between shots? How long does it take for this cycle to happen?
So the cycles take 2 weeks to complete. But of course, you get good antibodies even before that, like a week to 10 days.
So conceivably.
But you would give the shot later, because these memory cells have long memory.
I'm just wondering if you could design something that would release one antigen and then another antigen a couple of
days later. Yes, of course. So in fact, we have done some work where with single antigen case so far, where you give just the antigen dose in a particular temporal profile that we had predicted would do better, just one antigen, but just the concentration is varied, and experiments in both mice and monkeys show this now. And so we do want to think about this situation that you say, give one antigen, the antigen, another. There's one challenge, though. I live in MIT, right? So there's this guy called Bob Langer. He can make you any dose you want of any antigen and so on with his devices. They're expensive.
Tiny time capsules.
Yeah, so that something like that. But, you know, the problem is that I hate to bring non-science into this picture, but I go to South Africa every year, and we also have collaborations there. These are very resource-poor settings outside of the main cities, and that's where the challenge is. So it can't be like an osmotic pump or something like that.
I was wondering if you could encapsulate them microscopically into some kind of particles.
And then they have some
slowly.
Yeah. But maybe I'll ask Bob. See, he should know how to make those things. But yeah, it's true. Because that's an important point, because bringing those people back a second time is a challenge.
I got a little bit confused in the last part, so I just, so the Z variables that you had that was the sequence space for the virus, right?
Yes.
And the interactions that you're deriving are from looking at the prevalence.
Yeah, so let me show you. I skipped all this, so I can just tell you very quickly. Mm. I have done this graph in Ising representation for simplicity.
Okay.
The reality is we use a POTS version because there are many amino acids possible at any. But for simplicity, let's say that ZK is the kth sequence, and ZI in kth virus is 0 or 1, either wild type or mutant.
Mm-hmm.
We are seeking P, this is, all, is actually done in POTS version. So P of ZK is the probability distribution we are seeking. This is its entropy. We want to maximize it, subject to constraint that it is normalized.
Mm-hmm.
Constraint that the predicted one point from P of Z is what is observed, and that the predicted two point is what is observed. And you enforce these constraints through Lagrange multipliers. And then you do two lines of algebra taking the functional derivative of this with respect to P of ZK, and you will get this.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Now, how do we get the JIJs and HI? You can show that once you assume this form, not assume, that it has this form, then the likelihood of the data is maximized by HIs and JIJs that fit the 1 and 2 point mutational probabilities. So then it becomes a very hard numerical inverse Ising or inverse POTS problem. And the numerics of this can be quite challenging. The gentleman over there, Remy Monison, along with Simona, has built some of the best algorithms to do that. And we initially started out doing this before we knew of their work by doing very stupid things, which were going to be done for the smaller things. And then we have imported their methodology in order to do this for all of these things afterwards, except for envelope, which even their methodology failed.
For which
we just published a paper in PNAS where we had to get a better guess of this by something called maximal probability flow before doing their cluster expansion. So roughly speaking, what they do is they break it up into little clusters. This J matrix is quite sparse, so they can start out with saying that it's just independent particle, then find what are the best pairs, and then what are the next triplets, each time capturing so much of the entropy in the data. So that's roughly what they do.
But no, but at the end of this, what you have is a landscape that tells you where the populations are clustered, right?
They're not clustered, they're quite uniform, but except for the basin business that
basin.
I told you, but in a power law sense, yeah.
No, but in terms of the analogy to the Hopfield network, I'm not seeing it because the fact that the basins are clustered, so what is associative about these clusters?
Yeah, so the fact that what is associative is that they are all showing us, remember there's one mutation, or several actually, that are driven by humans, immune response hitting it. The others are only the positively coupled ones.
Mm-hmm.
So it's telling us what collective effects the virus had to do in order to avoid certain types of immune responses.
Okay.
Because it had to make these compensatory mutations. And for our fitness landscape, it's teaching us which coupled mutations can it make to avoid human immune responses. So those are the positive GIG. We don't want to target those regions. But it also tells us which are not occurring more than by chance, which are the negative GIGs, and those are the parts we want to hit, because they cannot compensate those and get out.
Any last question, perhaps?
So it seems like you indicated that the immune system, as you presented it, is optimized for one new threat at a time, one new antigen or handful of related antigens.
I implied that, but I'm not certain of this.
Okay, that's what I was wondering. And are there is there a good reason why it might be optimized in such a way, or are there counterexamples?
It may well be. It may well be, but it has not dealt ever with something that is so mutable and so replicatable. So our error rate is 10^-9 per base pair per replication cycle. HIV is 10^-5. Flu is the same, by the way. But why is the diversity so different? Because HIV replicates much faster. In a single human, it makes 10^9 to 10^10 new virus particles a day. Some of them are just much lower. I don't remember the number. But and also, it's an acute infection, so you know, you either clear it quickly or. So I don't know that statement that I said is probably not much this level that I was saying. In fact, it's interesting for me to think about the following. Why have this affinity maturation process and let these somewhat bad B cells keep living stochastically? Maybe it is to deal with variants that may come along next time and this might grow out better than that. But that's all speculation. I do not know. But it's an interesting question.
Okay, I guess on that note, let's thank Al one more time. And I guess we'll continue at 2 in the afternoon.